Today on Wings, we dive into the big machine to hear from women who have been working on clean energy transition from inside the U.S. government.
The Defense Department is the largest energy consumer on the planet.
If you go with a business as usual projection, it looks pretty grim. But fortunately, the business as usual projection isn't what has to happen.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Green Connections Radio is a podcast focused on women and the clean energy economy, hosted and produced by industry veteran Joan Michelson. Today you'll hear excerpts from two of her interviews. First, an interview at the Pentagon.
Today, we're privileged to talk to the point person who is in charge of making sure that the U.S. Army meets its energy and environment goals, the Honorable Catherine Hammack, Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. Secretary Hammack has spent her entire career in energy and sustainability, mostly in the private sector with Ernst & Young and Arizona's largest electric utility, and President Obama appointed her as Assistant Secretary of the Army in 2010. She's also a mechanical engineer, which is very cool, with an MBA, and I'm sure they both serve her quite well in managing the energy issues of the Army installations worldwide. The Defense Department is the largest energy consumer on the planet, and the Army is the largest energy consumer in the federal government. In 2012, fiscal year 2012, the Army spent $4.8 billion on energy in the U.S. and overseas. The Army manages over a billion, that's with a B, square feet of building space. The Army has over 100,000 homes on bases used by over 2.2 million soldiers, families, and civilians. Over 70 to 80% of ground resupply convoys are water and energy. And that, of course, puts our men and women in harm's way.
And that's true when we are in theater or conflict theater. And it's interesting to note that in 2014, our energy costs came down to about $2.3 billion. But what's interesting is our energy costs are entirely dependent upon whatever the fight is that we're engaged in. So when we were engaged in both Iraq and Afghanistan, our liquid fuel costs were higher because our liquid fuel consumption was higher. But we still had the same number of permanent bases here in the United States.
It was higher because of getting them over there.
Getting them over there and then distributing them in theater. And that's the issue when we talk about convoys. Because once it enters country, we distribute it to central hubs. And then from those central hubs, we have to redistribute it to the medium-sized bases, and then out to the forward operating bases.
Well, to reduce that, you announced in 2011, not long after you arrived at the Pentagon, in fact, the Net Zero Initiative. How are you defining an effective rate of zero?
It's bringing everything into balance. So when we talk about net zero energy, first you reduce your energy consumption. And so when you've reduced your consumption as much as possible by being more efficient, then you look at offsetting the energy you consume by producing energy on site, primarily through renewable energy, whether it's solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, or even hydroelectric. And net zero water is getting our water consumption into balance because the aquifer that we draw water from is also shared with the community. And so we are using water as many times as we can, the same water before we reinject it back into the same aquifer that we withdrew it from. So you're not depleting the water level. But you know, water and energy are very linked together. It takes energy to pump, treat, distribute, collect, and then retreat water. And that's five different energy steps there. Net zero waste, a lot of people don't understand, but when you have a solid waste stream, there's resource value in it. There's resource value in metals. There's resource value in plastics. There's resource value in wood. It can all be reused for another purpose before you put it to final disposal. And so we've had some waste to energy companies come and look at our bases and say, stop recycling as much. We need those plastic water bottles or wooden pallets or other materials in the waste stream because they have a high BTU content and make more energy. But that's not really what we want to do. We want to increase our recycling and reduce our waste stream. So that last little bit is waste energy or landfill. Because, you know, there's companies that have started up in business with the whole business plan is mining landfills. And so the question is, what do we want our generation to be known for? I mean, landfills are future archaeological digs. And they'll really take a look at us and think, what on earth were they thinking about by throwing away these resources?
Yeah.
So we have the means to recycle things today, and that's the best use of resources, is reusing.
So tell us a couple of examples from the pilot program that you launched last year, I guess, where they're doing something innovative.
It doesn't always take innovation to do it. It just takes taking that first step. So one of our industrial plants where we make munitions looked at their water use, and their water use was high. And what they did is they put in ultrasonic leak detectors and moved them around to find their leaks. And so they fixed 6 of the biggest leaks, and that reduced their water consumption by 23%.
Wow, 6 leaks reduced their consumption by 23%?
But you know, in Washington, D.C., just this morning on the news, I heard of another water main break. And we are not managing our water distribution in our cities. And that's what our Army bases are, is they are cities. So the first thing is fixing your leaks. Whether they're wastewater leaks or potable water leaks, drinking water leaks, let's first fix those. Then step 2, after you've fixed your leaks, is to take a look at where you're using water, where you're generating waste, where you're using energy. Because sometimes you don't know. The more you know, the better you're able to manage it. So we have a meter data management system where on a base, they have barracks, and barracks look like dormitories. And what we'll do is we'll monitor the energy consumption of every one of the barracks on the base. Now, they're operating on the same base in the same climate zone. They have about the same utilization, and we'll diagram their energy consumption per square foot for that month. There's always going to be the one that didn't use much, and then there'll be the outlier, the one that used a whole lot. And those go to the commander's monthly update briefs.
Wow.
And this is where we talk about behavior change. You know, when you're the commander of the barracks that is the biggest energy consumer that month, that's not the kind of leadership recognition you want.
Plus, it's reminding people of what they can change and where progress is, too. So
absolutely,
it can be a positive reinforcement as well as a negative reinforcement, I would imagine.
Well, that's what we did in our homes. We have the Residential Communities Initiative, where we have privatized our housing. And this is where we pay for base housing, including utilities, for our soldiers.
Hmm.
But how do you hold them accountable?
Right.
We are monitoring every one of the homes now with meters. And you do not pay an energy bill if you're in the middle third of the band. The lower third of the band of consumption gets a check back.
Cool.
The higher third of consumption gets a bill. Our consumption has gone down by more than 20%, letting people know it isn't free. And one base did this great thing where instead of giving you a check, they give you a catalog.
Oh, it's like rewards points?
It's like rewards points. And you
correct.
Know what? If the kid wants a new game, they can earn points.
The DOD faces significant budget cuts. How is the DOD having to adapt this program in the face of those budget cuts? Because it takes capital investment to make some of these systems happen. You know, you can put in these systems, but it takes time and it takes money.
It does, but we're partnering with the private sector.
So how do those partnerships work?
Well, one of them is energy savings performance contracts. So we invite a contractor to come on our base and say, let us know what kind of energy savings you think we should implement. And what's the return on investment? So if they come in and implement new LED lighting or new air conditioning control systems, they know what that return on investment is. They install it, they finance it, and we pay them out of the savings in our utility account. So there's no cost, no incremental cost to the taxpayer up front. It's essentially paid for when the savings are achieved.
How do you involve the community and the ecosystem issues? Because as you said earlier, you're sharing the same water, for example, and in some cases sharing the same energy. So how do you do that?
Some of these public-private partnerships have to do with renewable energy. So in several cases, we're partnering with the utility, the same utility that delivers you energy. They'll come and install renewable energy on the Army base. And think of it this way. They don't have to pay for the land, and the permitting's a lot quicker, and their end-use customer is on the base. We'll buy the energy from it, but it's lower cost for them to produce it. And by the way, the power lines that are bringing power to our base are not as stressed, because now we've relieved some of the load. So that means there's more power available to the community, and maybe it'll be a longer period of time before they have to replace that infrastructure because there's less stress and strain on it. So we're partnering with the private sector and the public sector on renewable energy.
Every community has businesses or universities that have multiple locations or giant campuses. What can the private sector actually learn from this?
One of the biggest things is to focus on your core competencies. The core competency of the Army is training and equipping soldiers to fight this nation's wars. Our core competency is not running utilities, is not running water treatment plants. That is where we need private sector, and we've encouraged private sector to come in, privatize some of these systems so that they can do the work that is their core competency. So when everyone focuses on their core competency, we're all more efficient and more resilient.
And that's where the partnerships come in. Let's talk about you for a moment. What inspired you to study mechanical engineering?
I studied mechanical engineering because I didn't want to be a math major. So when I went to college, I was thinking about being a math major, and I got around to talking to the dean about what does a math major do, and he essentially said, teach. And I don't think I have the patience to teach. And so I said, okay, what else can you do? And he said, go into engineering. Now, I was reluctant to go into it initially because my father's an electrical engineer, my brother's an industrial engineer.
Oh.
So when I went into engineering, I went into mechanical engineering because they weren't in it. So that was
your differentiation.
It was my differentiation. You got to be independent somewhere.
I bet you were, if not the only one of the very few women in your class.
There were about three.
There were three out of?
About 500.
Wow. And why did you leave the private sector to come to the Army?
Because I got a phone call one day from the White House saying your country needs you.
That's quite a transition, though.
It is, but you know what? Buildings are buildings, and energy efficiency is energy efficiency. So whether you're in the Army or in the private sector, some of the basic principles still apply.
But when you're a consultant, you're not doing the operations so much. And here, you're more involved in the operations directly.
Well, you get to see the results of your work, too. And so that's very fulfilling. When you can see a operational base in Afghanistan that used to have a fuel resupply every 3 days, due to efficiency, now has a fuel resupply every 10 days. That means they can focus on the mission more, they've reduced their vulnerabilities and reduced their risks. And sometimes we say saving energy saves lives.
That was Catherine Hammock, Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Army for Installations, Energy, and the Environment. The interviewer was Joan Michelson of Green Connections Radio. Next on Wings, excerpts from Michelson's interview with Ellen Williams, head of ARPA-E, the innovation arm of the U.S. Department of Energy.
We are in the midst of an energy revolution with massive and rapid innovation occurring every day. One of the leaders of this energy revolution is the U.S. government in a bipartisan effort. President George W. Bush signed legislation to create the Advanced Research Projects Agency/Energy, known as ARPA-E. President Obama allocated about $90 billion to clean energy initiatives with the Recovery Act in 2009, and that included funding to jumpstart America's ability to take a leading role and gain the economic advantages in this massive energy revolution. The best person on the planet to talk to about the promising new energy technologies coming out of ARPA-E is Dr. Ellen Williams, the executive director of ARPA-E, and we are at her offices in Washington, D.C. So RPE's mission, according to the website, is to advance high-potential, high-impact energy technologies that are too early for private sector investment. Take out the technical risk, right? A little bit about Dr. Williams is she's a chemical engineer who, interestingly, was chief scientist of British Petroleum. Dr. Williams was also a senior advisor to the Secretary of Energy and served as a distinguished university professor in the physics department of University of Maryland for many, many years. And she founded the University of Maryland's Materials Research, Science, and Engineering Center. Let's start off, Dr. Williams, with where is the energy revolution today? What are the trends?
Oh, the trends in the energy revolution are toward growing impact. In specific technology areas, I would say all across the energy spectrum. So we take a look at the energy spectrum in terms of transportation, in terms of energy efficiency and related resource efficiency, in terms of the electric power grid, and in terms of clean power generation. All of those different areas are seeing incredible advances. And I would say one of the new things that we're seeing is more and more the way that different parts of the energy system can work together and be coordinated to create bigger impacts than any one by itself can generate.
So how does that work?
We invest in a spectrum of performers. So about 40% of our performers actually come from universities, and about a third come from small businesses, and others from nonprofit organizations, federal laboratories, and so on. So we've got a whole spectrum of people who come into us and are given funding to try to develop clean energies. And that's one of the really exciting things for us, is that there is such an infrastructure of science and engineering expertise in the United States across all these different units, and very strong innovative and entrepreneurial spirit also. We really are drawing on that strength of the U.S. community in these areas. And then we bring together teams. University teams may pair with a large business. The university can bring in incredibly creative, cutting-edge ideas. The business brings in the know-how about what it takes to take a creative idea and turn it into something that is ready for uptake in the actual commercial sector.
Well, companies like Raytheon and even Xerox have gotten some of the funding from RPE. They don't really need the money. I mean, they have their own money. I would think that the whole point of RPE is to give money to help stand up entrepreneurs who don't have any other access to resources, if you will. Why give money to a Raytheon?
The vast majority of our money, as I said, goes to university teams and small business teams. But we see a huge benefit, first of all, in bringing in the expertise from large companies. Often we have partnerships when we fund large companies. And the other part of our function is to invest in early stage research, research that is too risky for the private sector to invest in. And so if you go to a big company and you talk to the scientists and engineers, they will have phenomenal ideas, but they are too high risk for the company to invest in. They will not be funded by the company to do that research. So our requirement is that when we go into a project with anybody, we really make sure that this is too high risk, too early stage, that the private sector won't pick that up. And then we just carry it far enough to de-risk that technology. And then we start to look for the handoff partner. Who's going to pick this up and take it further?
Who owns the IP?
In all cases, the performer owns the IP.
So the performer being the recipient of the grant.
The recipient of the grant owns the IP. Again, this is part of our philosophy that entrepreneurship and innovation is a huge driver of creativity and advances in the clean energy sector.
Well, and if companies can't own the IP, there's no interest. It's one of the struggles is the labs maintain ownership of the IP. And that's been a struggle with getting public partnerships with them. Where do you see energy sourcing coming from in, say, 10 or 20 years? Where will we be getting our energy from percentage-wise in 10, 20 years?
Well, so there's lots of different projections on that. If you go with a business as usual projection, it looks pretty grim. But fortunately, the business as usual projection isn't what has to happen. And as technologists, we're here to change that projection. So the projected growth is going to depend on a combination of technical innovation and policy decisions. But we definitely need to see that the mix of clean energies has to increase rapidly, and we know it's possible for that to happen. So with the right continuing development of technology, plus a little bit of incentives for policy, we know that we can start to meet the goals of driving up the clean energy components, solar, wind, nuclear, hydro, and getting those up to the 25, 30, and so on percentage of our energy delivery that we have to reach.
25 or 30%, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I still believe that
that's not a prediction.
No, I understand, but I still believe that the fossil fuel company, there will be a role for it, and you need
absolutely.
To, and that we need to get them to clean up their act. I mean, it's really goofy, you know, what they're doing right now. So what are you really excited about? I mean, I've seen some technologies. One of the things that lights me up a little bit, pardon the pun here, is the street lighting, the smart lighting that gives internet access, and it alerts the police, and it gives all kinds, it collects data, basically.
Yeah.
It becomes a data center, too, as well as an energy source, which is so multi-purpose, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm an innovation freak. What really, you know, what lights you up? What's exciting to you?
So one of our projects that we're watching with bated breath, they're an alumni team. They finished up with us several years ago. It's called Makani. And the idea that they had was, right now, the amount of wind power we can generate is limited in a sense, because there's only certain parts of the country where the wind is strong enough and consistent enough.
I lived in North Dakota. I can vouch for that one.
But if you can go to higher elevations, the wind is steadier.
Really?
And stronger over a lot more of the United States. But you can't just build a wind tower 1,000 feet tall. I mean, it just becomes mechanically intractable. So their idea was, instead of building a physical tower, take the wind generator up on a small aero vehicle. And that sounds crazy.
Is it like a drone?
It's like a drone. It's an unattended air vehicle. And so the idea is that its propellers are going to do dual purpose. You fly your air vehicle up to the right elevation, and then you fly it in a circle that matches the path of the tips of a wind turbine blade. As it's flying in a circle, the crosswinds then start to spin the propellers even faster, and you capture that extra energy and turn it into electricity.
So it's catching, in effect, the spin-off from the turbines rotating, not just what the turbines are capturing, but the spin-off from it, too.
Well, it's not a perpetual motion machine.
Oh, okay.
It's definitely not a perpetual motion machine. It's really capturing the wind energy that's flowing past those turbines. And so it's a tricky business, because the propellers have to both control the motion of the UAV and catch the wind energy. So we funded this team to solve their aerodynamics questions of how do you fly a plane while at the same time capturing wind energy with it. They did incredibly well. They put a demo up, flew it around, and practically the minute they landed on the ground, Google X purchased them and has been developing the technology ever since. And they're looking to go commercial in the next couple of years. So we're watching that, and we're very excited, because that could expand how much wind you can use in the United States. Plus, it's probably a very good technology for offshore wind.
That sounds like a longer conversation. So how do you address concerns that the government is picking winners? I mean, I know that there's a rigorous evaluation process, and I know, as you said, you get them from various different sources.
Yeah.
But there are people who will say that it's the government picking winners. What's your, I'm sure you've had this question 100 million times, but what's your answer?
So our answer to that is that when we go into a program and put out a call for proposals, what we do is we set up the criteria that we want the program to meet. For instance, the criterion would be, you will deliver solar energy at this level of efficiency, at this cost, and so on. And so we just set up the goals of the program. The project proposals come in, and we work very hard to select a portfolio of projects that span all sorts of different approaches to solving that problem.
Oh, so you're not picking a winner in terms of, you're not picking one technology to solve one problem. You're funding multiple ways to solve the same problem.
That's right. And then we expect that coming out of that, some of those ways will develop better and will really demonstrate their ability to move forward. And that happens during our projects. And then at the end, we work really hard with our teams to prepare them. We call it at month 37, what are you going to be doing? Because we fund them for 3 years. And at month 37, we prepare them to be going out and finding that next level of funding to continue to develop their technology.
Or hopefully looking for it before they leave.
Yeah.
So that begs the question, how do you allocate the funding in terms of technology mix? Obviously, there's wind, solar,
right.
data, even
yep.
fusion, fuel cells,
yep.
hydropower, microgrids.
Yep.
How do you decide what the mix is?
Yeah, so that's also part of our portfolio. Because we are an innovation program, we're constantly changing our portfolio. So about a third of our programs end every year. We only fund a certain program for 3 years, then it ends. And so every year we're funding a third new programs. So that's our portfolio of different program topics, and we try to maintain a balance over time between the different areas of the energy sector, clean power generation, the activities of the electric grid and grid storage, energy efficiency, and transportation. So we're constantly changing that distribution so that overall we maintain a portfolio pretty much covers the entire energy sector. But the real reason, of course, that we're dynamic is that we're also changing our emphases to address new opportunities. So the types of programs that we would have funded 8 years ago are quite different from the types of programs that we're funding today. For instance, we're right now doing a competition called NextCar, and in that competition, we're asking teams to bring us ideas about how you could use the capabilities of vehicle automation to save energy.
Okay. Cool. Well, I spent years in the electric car division, so that speaks to me. One of the things that Green Connections focuses on a lot is advancing women. So what advice would you have for women who want to get into the clean energy economy?
Well, the generic advice is be confident. I know that women are really highly incentivized by the importance of this topic and really want to work in this field. I talk to so many young women who are phenomenal, talented, outstanding, and they're worried that they're not good enough. They're good enough. They're really good enough. So number one is be confident. And number two is follow your dream. And number three is identify your strengths, your skill sets, and identify the skill sets that are needed, and just never let go on pushing your skills to their ultimate performance level and demonstrating what you can do. And I think I would encourage companies to really emphasize that aspect of the motivation, why it is so important, and to recognize that a man and a woman may not talk and walk just the same way, but those differences don't necessarily mean that one or the other is better or worse, that those differences can really bring different perspectives and different capabilities into the room, and don't write one off in favor of the other.
And that's where innovation comes from, because you have different thoughts at the table.
You do.
That's where you get the diversity from. Do you mean that women make career choices based more on values?
I certainly know lots of women who are very value-driven in their choices about what they do. And so very often in our day-to-day work, we know why we're doing it in the back of our minds, but I think it's really good and important to bring it forward pretty often and remind ourselves, why are we doing this, how important it is, why it really matters to us.
Ellen Williams, head of ARPA-E, the innovation arm of the U.S. Department of Energy. Wings thanks Green Connections radio producer Joan Michelson for sharing podcast episodes with Wings. You can find more of her podcasts on iTunes or through her website, greenconnectionsradio.com. To hear this or other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.